Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm delighted to be here and a little daunted to be here with Richard Feidler to discuss his new book, Ghost Empire. Now, you may know that Richard Feidler heads up a conversation hour in which he delves into the lives of others. Now I get to delve into the life of Richard Feidler. Welcome, Richard.
Hello. It's a horrible business delving into my life. You probably come out of it somewhat soiled and regretful, but I hope it's not too horrible for you.
Last night I had a bit of a panic attack. I hadn't really considered it, and as I was preparing to get into bed with the book and to continue reading, when it just struck me what I was going to be doing the next day, and I was a little daunted. As an interviewer, what is it like when you face being on the other side?
This is lovely, this bit. I feel for you, brother. I mean, I never do an interview without feeling slightly terrified before it starts. Never, because there's so much you've got to keep going in your head and you really want to do justice to the person who's talking. So to be interviewed, to be an interviewee, is incredibly luxurious and a bit slack, quite frankly. And I'm appalled at my guests now that I think, looking back, they have to do very little to prepare for an interview and I do all the work. And then I don't talk very much. So, yes, this is lovely, all this. I'm enjoying the attention, I suppose, yes.
So, this book, this beautiful, beautifully designed book, just a moment ago you were describing that you did the design for the front cover of it. It's a hardcover with gold on it, a picture of Istanbul, or is it Constantinople, when this drawing was done?
It's Constantinople by then, I think, although it might have become Istanbul now that I think about it. Actually, it may even have been illustrated at the time when it had shifted to become Istanbul, actually, but it's the Great Walled City anyway.
It's a book that looks like it is to be kept and treasured. It's a thick book. Where did this book come from? My concern here is this book seems to have come from nowhere, but as a lifelong reader and an interviewer of people and a history of interest in historian, it must have some base. Where did this book come from?
Well, one of my great secret passions has always been history. I'm a big reader of history. I read so much of it in my 20s, along with literature, but a lot of history. I adore history. And sometime around about 7 or 8 years ago, I got on this Roman history binge. I thought, I was treating ancient Rome like an undiscovered continent that I'd visit one day. I had a bit of it from school, and I thought, one day I'll get back and follow the history of the Romans. And I did. And I did it with my son, who is a lovely guy, Joe, who would listen to the same podcast as me, and we'd talk, and he'd ask me stories, to tell stories about it. And by the time we got to the end of Roman history, the conventional end of Roman history, which is when the boy emperor Romulus Augustulus abdicates in the 5th century in Italy somewhere, I thought, I'll keep on going. And the thing about Roman history, most of us are taught that it ends with the abdication of Romulus Augustulus. He's sent off his throne by a barbarian chieftain in 476 AD. But it's not really true, because the Empire of the Romans kept rolling right along in the east, in Constantinople, for another 1,000 years. And this is kind of, again, another undiscovered continent, but much less well-known. I had sort of read bits and pieces of it in the past, a bit of John Julius Norwich's books on what we're now called Byzantium. But it's been shockingly overlooked, and it seemed to me to find out about these stories of Constantinople, well, it was like finding this beautiful treasure chest of rare jewels and amazing stories and weirdness and human, every kind of human story as well, and superstition. It's such a rich trove. I was really shocked that we don't know it better.
Have you discovered why that has happened?
Yes, I have. It comes about through a total bastard called Edward Gibbon. Edward Gibbon, who wrote the multi-volume Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, one of the first great titanic works of modern Western history, and a man admired for his superb epigrammatic sentences. He documented the decline of the Roman Empire, and when he got to the 1,000 years of Byzantium, he went, oh, it's just a tedious tale of superstition and violence and vulgarity and in no way warranting the greatness of the Roman name. So he disdained this. He wrote about them like they were effete, hopeless, uncultured idiots. And it's exactly the opposite. The thing is, Gibbon and other writers, like Voltaire, I think, wrote terrible things about Byzantium as well, is that these were gentlemen of the Enlightenment. And the story of a medieval theocratic civilization like Byzantium, it was repugnant to them, just repugnant. They just seemed mired in superstition. But the question these idiots forgot to ask was, if it was so hopeless, if it was so pathetic, how come it endured for 1,100 years? How was it that Constantinople became by far the greatest, biggest, most cultured, most dynamic, richest city in Europe, and at times in the whole world throughout the Middle Ages?
It does seem a bit of an error to have made.
Well, I think we have this misapprehension that the winds of civilization are always going westward. You know, civilization begins in Mesopotamia and it goes from there to ancient Egypt, keeps going west to Greece, then to ancient Rome, then to the Western Europe of the Renaissance, then it goes over the United States, and then it ends up in California where it dies. That's where civilization dies. It just keeps going westward. And we have this idea that the Middle Ages were the Dark Ages. And yes, they were the Dark Ages in Western Europe. But in Eastern Europe and in India and China, Byzantium, Persia, Arabia, this is a period of flourishing, a great flourishing period of technology and art and mathematics and science and culture and out-and-out weirdness, and the creation of, you know, the formation really of the two great world religions of Christianity and Islam. This is a fascinating period, but it's our Western prejudices that we're brought up with, mostly, that stop us seeing it straight.
Can you tie it to Catholicism? Is it tied to their story?
To some degree. The most shameful episode in the whole of the history of Byzantium was the sack of Constantinople in 1204 by the Crusaders, the Fourth Crusade, which were led by French knights and Venetian sailors, if you like. It was Venetian boats and French knights. And that's in my book, and it's one of the most low-down tales of greed and treachery and low cunning, sort of dressed up in high moral principle that you can ever read. Like, you walk away from that story feeling vaguely soiled. And it's the reason why St. Mark's Basilica in Venice looks as beautiful as it does. It's adorned with the treasures of Constantinople.
It is interesting, because I remember being told that, and in my mind, at the time of telling, because I had a dark spot, it would seem like the right thing to do at the time. You go to these perilous barbarian areas, grab their gold, bring it over to make sure that it's looked after by good Western folk.
Well, it was more like a sort of a boatloads of bogans from the West showed up in the most civilized city in the world and smashed it to pieces and tore took its treasure from it. And those four horses that sit on top of the entrance of St. Mark's, they were taken from the Hippodrome in Constantinople. They're ancient statues of four rearing horses. They were stolen from the Hippodrome, torn down, heads cut off, and stuck back on once they got back to Venice. Statue of the four emperors in the corner, the marble columns out the front. You can't quite see, once you know the story of the sack of Constantinople by the Fourth Crusade, you can't see St. Mark's in Venice the same way. It looks like a great big magpie's nest.
I'm interested in the actual book itself, in the way that you've put it together, because with someone who has an interest in history and they've been reading history all their lives, and although not a historian, you may have gone down the path of going into a popular history, mm-hmm. Nathaniel's Nutmeg or something like that. Then there's the other option of doing some sort of travel memoir of going over to these places and writing them in the sort of the Jan Morris kind of way. But you've chosen this hybrid of approach. How did you come to write the book the way you've written it?
I think I like to see what I do in radio. It's a kind of form of storytelling, really. My show's called Conversations, but it's a bit of a misnomer. It's not really a conversation. I don't really say that much. I try not to anyway. I try to let my guests talk. And it's more of a guided storytelling. And it's a similar approach. With the book, I went there with my son because he loves history as much as I do, and because I wanted to sort of tell these stories that I'd found about the Eastern Roman Empire, about Byzantium, and tell them to Joe in a way that could make sense of them to me, and then through Joe to a general reader. So I don't really see this as being a complicated and academic work at all, of course, as you say, it's popular history. It's more a case of bringing these stories to light that are there in all the accounts to help them make sense to Joe. But the larger thing of it was to really just try and inhabit the mindset of people in the Middle Ages. I'm really fascinated by that. I really have my doubts about the Enlightenment. I think there is something about living in that world of medieval fabulous colour and superstition. There was a Dutch historian, Huizinga, who wrote about the kind of nervous tenor of medieval life. And I want to sort of feel that being in a city like that, to try and imagine how it felt to be a citizen, to walk down those streets, to go to the Hagia Sophia, to walk along the Theodosian walls of Constantinople, which are all still there, and to inhabit that medieval mindset. So the people in that city, the Christians in Constantinople, as they were, and they were, you know, Orthodox Christians, they saw themselves as the central actors in this great cosmic drama that was being played out. They lived in the capital of the world. The emperor was God's regent on earth. And they knew there would one day be an apocalypse where the hordes, which they call Gog and Magog, predicted in the Bible, would ride somewhere out of the east and swarm over the city. And that would be the Christian apocalypse. It would be the end of the world and the coming of the Antichrist and the second coming of Christ eventually. And they believed they had a central role in that. They had all these prophecies that they believed. And the day came. The day came in 1453 when the Turks arrived. The Ottoman Turks finally arrived with the biggest cannon in the world, which they used to shatter the walls of Constantinople. And as prophesied, funnily enough, ironically, some of the prophecies came true. They came through a certain door in the walls of Constantinople, which was predicted in the prophecies. They came streaming down, taking things, taking slaves as they wanted to. And many people in the city expected a great big annihilating angel to appear in front of the Hagia Sophia and cut down the hordes with God's holy sword, and they would have been protected inside the Hagia Sophia. But it didn't happen. And they hold themselves up in the Hagia Sophia. There was about 1,000, 2,000 people holed up there, waiting for an angel to intervene. And can you just imagine the holy terror that induces when finally the Janissaries, the Sultan's elite soldiers, bash down the doors of the Hagia Sophia and break through? I mean, so that's, I wanted to kind of understand that kind of what it's like to live in that world where everything's explainable through, everything is unfolding just as it should, and then it doesn't.
I got this moment of these people when the doors smash open, of skipping the Enlightenment and going straight to existentialism. Well, that's pretty all right, isn't it?
Yes, that's
right. It's bound to happen.
Yeah, there they are, trapped, being rounded up by Janissaries and murdered and what have you, and going, where's Sartre and Camus when we need them now?
Yeah.
Yes.
But the prophecies told them which door was coming in. Couldn't they have made it stronger?
Yeah, well, I know.
But I, in reading the book, you've got... This is what I was talking about with the travel memoir, the history, sort of the hybrid, is you do have bits where you bring in Joe...
And the present day,
in the present day, and you also bring in past thoughts, like the birth of Joe appears in the book. Was that something that came naturally, or was that something that...
It evolved, actually. Yeah. I ended up writing quite a bit about fatherhood, about being a father and being a son. That came through all the time. You sort of think you think you're writing one book, and then another whole other elements just appear as you write it. And that was a very strong element. That came through all the time, and then I started seeing it in the histories as well. These really moving and occasionally appalling father-son narratives that popped up, and father-daughter narratives too, in the histories as well. And this is all unfolding as I'm there with my son, who's 14, and. It's about, you know, leaving his boyhood behind. There's a bit of pain in that. And, I make the reflection that while I was there, we don't have these coming of age ceremonies for 14-year-old boys in Jewish and Aboriginal people do in Anglo-Australian culture, the culture I come from, Anglo-Irish culture.
Unless you consider handing him a VB.
That's right, a VB at 14. Yeah. That'd be a bit strong. Yeah. So this was a way of introducing Joe into a bigger world, I think, in these larger historical stories, because he was always interested in that. Well, I've since been told that the bar mitzvah is a rite that's undertaken, not for the benefit of the kid, but for the parents. It's actually there for the parents, the bar mitzvah. It's to really make it clear to mum and dad that their darling baby boy is no longer a baby boy and is growing up and will be leaving the nest at some point soon. It really has to be drummed into the parents. And that's what this was for me as well, this feeling of a kind of a last summer with my son as a boy, who's now a strapping teenager of 17 and is as tall as I am and is a lovely guy, but he's not that boy that he was back then. So I was also charting that change of him from early adolescence, from boyhood into early adolescence, which is terribly poignant and moving. It makes you, brings up your own memories of your own adolescence as well.
Well, you may be very jealous. Just to be able to take a son or daughter to, I have taken a 14-year-old to London and tried to share my experience.
That would have been fantastic.
London.
14-year-old wasn't that interested?
No, not that interested.
Right.
And I've done it twice now in a row. More interest out of the 15-year-old girl than the 14-year-old boy.
But, right. Yes.
Yeah, it'd be great to sort of have that relationship where you have that sense of a shared, interest in history.
I was like my own relationship with my own dad. We never had the wherewithal to travel overseas, but I never did with my dad, but I would follow him around like a puppy dog for quite a bit, and he would tell stories. My dad was a very charismatic guy and was an autodidact, didn't even finish high school, but became a great reader in early adulthood throughout the rest of his life. And so I was pestering him for stories of history as a kid, in much the same way my son pestered me for stories. And my dad always tried to give me his best answer, and I tried to do the same for my son as well, and admit where I get wrong, and open. And we have arguments, Joe and I, too, about the interpretation of certain things, and we can't agree on the morality of the bombing of Hiroshima, for example, yeah. That kind of stuff. I really enjoy that.
I get hit with, he's pressed the explanation button.
Mansplaining.
Yeah, it's just on my
Yeah, my daughter's like that. Yeah. She goes, stop dad, that's enough.
That's enough, you're done.
Well, yeah. Yes. It's a bit like that, that episode of The Simpsons where, I always think of Simpsons episodes, where Homer Simpson's making a speech about putting up a stop sign, and the local council call on him to make a speech, and they say, Mr. Simpson, and he gets up and says, since the time of the dinosaurs, man has, get on with it, Simpson. Okay, I want a stop sign. Yeah, that's what normally my family life is like. I'm lucky to have a son who indulges me.
I just want to talk about your reading because it fascinates me where books come from. And you say that you've had a few lives and being a member of the Doug Anthony All-Stars meant that you were travelling around a lot. Mm-hmm.
That's where I did all my reading, yeah.
When you're talking about hours and hours in train stations and bus stations, mm-hmm. and back of cars and things like that.
Mainly in the back of a stinking Tarago, actually. That's going between Gladstone and Rockhampton or something like that. Most of the time. I did an arts degree at ANU and I did a fair bit of reading there, which was lovely. But I was quite young when I went to uni, and I think you can sort of read some of the great works and not really fully appreciate them. They introduce you to a world rather than really touch you it's when you read those great books before you've ever properly fallen in love.
Yeah,
it's a different thing. If you read them in a different way than you will in your 30s and your 40s and your 50s. And so I did a lot of reading in my, once I graduated, as it turned out, funny enough, I read a lot more history. I read a lot of literature in my early 20s and then a lot of history in my late 20s. And just kept on reading and reading and reading. And this was the balm. I do recall having this kind of moment. I don't really believe in epiphanies, but I did have a kind of a slight epiphany in my first year at uni, where I just moved to Canberra to go to ANU, and I didn't really know anyone. I knew one or two people, but not really. And I spent a lot of time alone, and I spent a lot of time hiding up in the Chifley Library at ANU, just reading there. And when you're 17 years old and you're in a strange city and you feel a bit unmoored, I think might have been tipping towards feeling depressed or something like that. But then I do remember looking at the shelves and shelves of books and thinking to myself, I will never get to the end of this. This is a kind of, I don't know, it's the magic pudding, isn't it, really? There's no end to the beautiful, wonderful books I can read in my life. And that gave me a sense of constant possible discovery, a sense of I'll always be able to find something to delve into, to travel into, even if it's in my own mind. And I think that's helped me stave off depression and and the desire for nostalgia as well. History and literature are very, very powerful like that. So I think that's always kept me optimistic in a funny way. And I've never forgotten that. Never forgot that moment.
Well, I'm glad that moment has led you through the life you've led and all the conversations you've had and meeting all these people, and then being able to write about a very large and complex issue in a way that I think you'll get a very large readership for.
Because thank you. I hope so.
Not only can you read it from end to end, I think you can actually dip in to this book as well. So you can actually pick out parts of history, because you tell these little neat stories within them. There are beginnings and ends in some of these stories.
I'm hoping it will work as a toilet book. Yes. I am, actually. Seriously.
The Great Bog
the kind book. Of thing you'll put there where you can just pick it and dive into. In that sense, I was a little bit inspired by Norman Davies' History of Europe, which is one of my all-time favourite books. It came out in the early 90s, I think, thereabouts, mid-90s, which is a huge tome.
Is that The Isles? Is that the,
no, it was before he wrote The Isles. Okay. It's a history of Europe. Mm. And it's the most fabulous book. It's so rich. And you can dip in at any point, and there are little capsule histories inside it. And I've gone back to that well again and again and again and again. It's a gigantic tome, but it's the perfect toilet book. Yeah.
One thing that kept coming up as I was reading it is the women.
Mm-hmm.
Strong women that had wielded great power and told great stories and were in the centre of great stories. I mean, I do think of it as a very manly world.
Oh, it's a very patriarchal world.
Yeah.
The Romans have a shocking history like that. And you really, there's no getting around it. I'm not going to bang the drum too hard for this, but you can't read Roman history without a kind of some kind of feminist awareness. You have to have it. It won't do you any good. Because women in ancient Roman history, they're either poisoners, whores, or the mothers of the nation. Now, does that really dovetail with your personal experience of dealing realistically with women in the world? No. And, you know, Livia being the great example in I, Claudius, you know, she's cunning and powerful, but she's the great poisoner. Or they're these beautiful, serene, like the queen, you know, they're like that. Or they're total whores, like Julia, Augustus's daughter. So it's like that. And that carried over somewhat into Byzantine times. Nonetheless, despite all of that kind of chauvinism that's there, powerful women still made their own way. And they were every bit as talented, as venal, as generous, and as ruthless as the male emperors were. In spite of everything, there were these very supremely powerful and extraordinary women who ended up becoming either co-empresses, like Theodora, the former burlesque dancer, comedian, and stripper, and courtesan turned empress. Or Irene, who rose to the top through just being a very, very good politician, but nonetheless staved off a threat again from her son, who really was supposed to, she was supposed to be minding the throne for, by having his eyes gouged out. I mean, man. it's fun telling this story. To women in particular, they go, yeah, good on you, you go, girl. And then you get to the bit where the son led a failed coup d'etat, so she had his eyes gouged out, and then he died of his injuries. You go, oh. But that's the truth of it. People, women aren't saints. They're not idols. There's no one who's a supremely inspiring figure in these stories. People aren't like that, and politics isn't like that. But women, I hope, I've tried to see them as clearly as possible. The most likable woman in the book, for me, was Anna Komnena. Anna Komnena, I had no idea about. She's the world's first female historian. She was the daughter of the Emperor Alexius Komnenos, and she made her own play for the throne on the death of her father, whom she adored. She was supremely well-educated. She had a first-rate education. She was appointed to head up a hospital for women and taught medicine in this hospital. When her father died, she tried to push her younger brother aside so her husband and she could become co-rulers, but they failed. And so after her husband died, she was sent into exile in a convent. But in the convent, she kept her lively mind entertained by writing a history, the Alexiad, the history of her father's reign.
That was in the Penguin Classics.
Yes, that's something you can buy it on the shelves now. And some of the primary sources I read were a little dull from Byzantium, but hers is so lively and interesting. And she kind of does this kind of humble brag at the start of her book. She says, yes, I am learned in these matters. I don't want to tire you too much without stating my qualifications. But yes, I am quite learned in these things, and I am well-versed in Homer the Poet. And she rolls off these kind of whole line about how well-versed she is in mathematics and philosophy and history. And there's this fabulous moment in her book when the Knights of the First Crusade come through Constantinople. And she's lived in this extremely exquisite courtly life, which is how things work. So it's a bit like Game of Thrones, you know. It's extreme civilized courtly life. And then these rough-handed, tall, barbarian knights come into the court and are being entertained by her father. And she takes one look at Bohemond, the Norman knight, and she writes in a disdainful way about him, but there's this gigantic, you know, this huge sexual undercurrent in him. She describes his physicality. Like, he's like a rough brute, but a very handsome one. And she's kind of admires the male form. And she's so recognizable as a modern person in that moment.
Richard, thank you very much for coming and talking about your new book, Ghost Empire. The a number of stories, I mean, we haven't even begun. We've just touched on a few of them. There are hundreds of stories told within your great story of Constantinople. Thank you very much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you, John.
Richard's book is available from booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.